Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers. It's your favorite professor here. It's early June, and one of the things we like to look at when it comes to historical anniversaries in early June is D-Day. And fortunately, very, very fortunately, one of our favorite professors is here with us at the Institute in the Buzzkill Bunker, Professor Phil Nash, our World War II expert. How are you, Professor?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much.
We want to enlighten the Buzzkillers about all the complications of D-Day. We tend to think about it as such an easy thing to understand. It's a big invasion. It's successful. It helps sort of the start of the Allied victory. But there's so much more to it than that. And that's what you're here for.
That's what I'm here for, sure.
What's the sort of situation in the war, 1944, is 1943 and 44, I tend to think of as sort of this lull, not an exactly a stalemate, but, you know, it's not the big German offensives seem to be over and successful, and yet the Allied offensives haven't taken any ground back. What's going on?
That's kind of true. By the spring of 1944, Germany's clearly losing the war. Everyone, including rational Germans, recognize this. Their complete collapse is not imminent. They're still sort of holding the Allies at bay. But they've suffered major setbacks, especially on the Eastern Front, and I'll say more about that later on. Mm-hmm. But the situation is that the Battle of the Atlantic has been won by the Allies in the previous year, 1943, and that's crucial because that allows the full American military buildup in Great Britain, prior to D-Day.
Now, by the Battle of the Atlantic, you mean the sort of Battle of the Mid-Atlantic?
The Mid-Atlantic, because remember, they're contesting control of the sea lanes with German U-boats.
Okay.
For the first half of the war. The U-boats are decisively defeated in May 1943. In fact, Yeah, and that's crucial because, remember, you are moving large numbers of American troops and also equipment and lend-lease aid across the Atlantic in merchant ships.
Sure.
By air. But by sea.
Right.
You have to secure those sea lanes before you can build up American forces in Britain in order to then launch the famous cross-channel invasion.
And I suppose the winning of the Battle of the Atlantic isn't as decisive in terms of a one day it suddenly happens, but it's something we kind of overlook. There aren't any great movies
It is a necessary precondition for opening the so-called Second Front, which is the Second Front in Northern Europe, as opposed to like North Africa or Italy, which is already underway.
Right. Okay. Well, there you go. There's one more adding a contextual addition
Part of the context. Another part of the context is by the spring of 44, Allies, at least over Western Europe and over Germany, have come to completely dominate the skies.
Yes.
The combined bomber offensive of the British and American bombers can now bomb deep into Germany with long-range fighter escorts. And that's absolutely crucial because Americans bombed during the day and their bombers were suffering huge losses in 1943. Mm-hmm. That turns around early 1944 and the Luftwaffe, they are now the hunted.
Okay.
The Germans have completely abandoned the air over France.
Right.
And that is a really important precondition for a successful invasion in the West is Allied control of the air.
Okay.
There's a campaign in Italy, which has been a really frustrating stalemate for the Allies. They land in southern Italy in 1943, but by spring of 1944, they're still stuck south of Rome.
Because fighting up the Italian peninsula must be terribly difficult.
It is, and here's your Churchill content quotient. It is not the soft underbelly
check.
Of the... Exactly, check. It is not... the Churchill censors will be pleased. It's not the soft underbelly of the Axis.
Yeah.
The Germans are very, very tenacious and effective in defending that rough terrain. And, you know, it's a narrow peninsula, very easy to defend.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a stalemate in Italy.
On
the Eastern Front, this is where on the ground the most progress is being made against the Germans.
Okay.
By the spring of 44, the Germans have lost a lot of the ground that they had occupied in the Soviet Union. The front is stable more or less in the spring of 1944. That's going to change in a minute.
Yeah.
But it's pretty much stable. But the Germans they're not going to win the war in the East. They no longer have any offensive power. They're in a defensive mode, and they're slowly being pushed back.
And it's as if the Soviet tide is going to turn the other way in a few months.
Right.
Is it in any way obvious to people, or this wishful thinking on behalf of the Allies and maybe panic on behalf of the Germans that it looks as if everything is collapsing in around Germany, except for that western, northwestern Europe.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to think about it. The Germans are definitely expect, as of late 43, they expect a cross-channel invasion, and they are preparing for it. Hitler orders the building what's called the Atlantic Wall, or sometimes it's called Festung Europa, in other words, Fortress Europe.
Right.
This is part of a larger problem, which someone like Paul Kennedy would call imperial overstretch.
The German
Empire, we may have mentioned this in another show, the German Empire is basically too big for the Germans to defend. They've got, this is often overlooked, they have 500,000 men defending Norway, waiting for an invasion that never comes.
Half a million.
That's a huge number of men.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you go from the Spanish border on the Atlantic coast up to Denmark, that's a long coastline.
Oh, sure.
That's hundreds and hundreds of miles.
And complicated. In other words, it's not exactly just one
line. It's very undulating. Yeah. Lots of nooks and crannies. And it has to be defended in one way or another, because that the Allied invasion could come anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so this is what we mentioned this in the Rommel show. Rommel was put in charge of these Atlantic defenses late 1943.
Right. One of our earlier shows on Erwin Rommel.
On Rommel. Yeah. And so the Germans build all these fortifications. They plant all these mines. They put all these beach obstacles against landing craft. But long story short, they can't defend everywhere. The defenses are very, very thick in the Pas de Calais, the narrowest point of the English Channel right across from Dover.
Where they think the invasion is going to come.
But other places, they are, as we'll find out the hard way, they are just spread too thin. There's not enough. They don't have enough men. They don't have enough concrete. They don't have enough mines. They don't have enough artillery.
Yeah, because you would think that in another type of circumstance, that the mining of harbors and major what look like landing areas or could be landing areas would be impenetrable. How could you possibly land in Normandy? You would hit mines every 5 seconds, but as you're saying, there's just too much to cover.
There's just too much. And there are other things they have to worry about. In Normandy, for example, there are big areas, flat, wide open areas, where Allies might land paratroopers and gliders. And so they were called Rommel's asparagus. They put these stakes in the ground and strung wire between them to disrupt any glider landings. Because, you know, gliders are these big wooden things
that glide
to a stop, and you need a wide open flat field, and if there are all these stakes with wires, you'll destroy these things, and so they're
kill them
you know, and there's Normandy's a big area. That's a lot of stakes and a lot of wire, and there's just not enough time, not enough men, not enough mines and concrete and obstacles to stop the invasion. There's just too much to defend looking back on it.
But even and when we get to the actual invasion itself, it shows you how there's too much to defend, but the fact that there are so many casualties and it's so difficult to do shows you how really awful it could have been
if Germany had had the capacity to defend all of the Atlantic coast the way they defended the Pas de Calais, this story could have ended much differently. But on the Allied side, there's also, as sort of background, Operation Overlord, which is what the cross-channel assault in 1944 was called.
Right, okay. But by the way, one of the things that I remember as a kid, you know, as a buzzling and being obsessed with World War II and all these great, fantastic, very masculine-sounding names, Fortress Europe.
Bolero.
Overlord.
Roundup, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yep, Overlord's a good one, I know.
They weren't coming up with, you know, wimpy.
Well, and also these days we're very literal, right? We call them like Operation Enduring Freedom, right? In other words, we have this inspirational phrase, but back then they're trying to, obfuscate what's going on. So the Overlord invasion 1944 is the culmination of a ongoing strategic debate between the British and the Americans, which we may have mentioned in an earlier podcast. But the British are really reluctant to do a cross-channel invasion because they're afraid of the costs involved.
Sure.
And Churchill has this, I think we talked about it, has this peripheral strategy. He wants to nibble around the edges.
Greece and Italy and everything else.
Right, and also rely on things like strategic bombing and commandos and resistance forces and economic blockade and that sort of thing, and sort of strangle the Germans slowly. Whereas, of course, the Americans are much more sort of, you know, get her done.
Yeah.
The Americans want a cross-channel assault in 1942, which would have been ridiculous. It would not have worked. We did not have the capability.
But on the other hand, there is a certain, I'll say right or correct, you do have to invade at some point.
Right. Because the issue is called the Second Front, and the Soviets have been pushing for a long time to have pressure relieved on their side of the war by a – quote-unquote serious commitment on the part of the Western allies, which, you know, actually Stalin had some nice things to say about the invasion of North Africa when it happened, but you want to engage and draw off maximum German forces, and you could argue that in North Africa and Italy, that's just not being accomplished.
Yeah, not enough being pulled away.
Whereas if you land close to Germany across the channel in France, that will siphon off significant German forces to the west and hasten their collapse.
Yeah, but on the other hand, what always impresses me about this part of the war, 42 especially, is, you know, there is a genuine debate, and you know, the Hogan's Heroes or the Great Escape or the movie version of all this stuff is that the British are too cowed to do a big invasion. But you know, the Churchill argument of the peripheral strategy isn't a bad argument.
No.
And the Stalin argument isn't a bad argument, and the right. Eisenhower
no,
argument.
No, these are legitimate disputes.
They could all work if done the right way, and it's not like someone's trying to shirk their duty.
Right. Or, and context is important. If you've lost 900,000 dead in World War I like the British did,
sure.
You have a very different viewpoint compared to the Americans who lost 130,000 dead, half of them from disease.
And you know, land invasion and land wars in Europe sound awfully bad to the British.
And remember in August 1942, there was the Dieppe raid where the British, for really no good reason, sacrificed a large number of Canadian troops, bashing their heads against these channel defenses. And so a lot of people were understandably gun-shy about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
People should also understand just how difficult amphibious landings are.
Oh, yeah.
It's an incredible undertaking. But we should ask, like, why Normandy was chosen. That's kind of an
interesting part of the debate. Yeah.
The obvious place to attack is where the channel is narrowest, right across the Pas de Calais. That's what the Germans are thinking. That's why their best defenses and their best units are there.
Uh-huh.
Overlord there probably would have been difficult, if not disastrous.
Okay.
Normandy is picked because it's, by the way, geographically, it's to the south and the west of the Pas de Calais, right?
Right.
France juts sort of into the Atlantic in that direction. Mm-hmm. Normandy.
Before you get to Brittany.
Right, exactly. Just north of Brittany. Normandy is, so it's not the Pas de Calais, so it's not as heavily defended, but it's still close enough to Britain that it's within the reach of Allied air cover.
Oh, okay.
Land, for example, in a place like Burgundy.
All right.
Or
okay.
Closer to the Spanish border. If you go that far south, you're going to outrun your fighter cover.
Okay.
Remember, you're at such a disadvantage coming up out of the ocean. You have to have control of the air, and you have to have lots of planes protecting you.
I never think about that. I only think about the fact that, okay, this is directly, more or less directly across the channel from Southampton. You go directly south. That makes sense. But I forgot that you have to have
largely about the air cover.
Oh, okay.
So the preparations were, of course, enormous. I mean, they're basically going to land all at once, basically 150,000 men. Which is a monstrous undertaking. The logistics involved, the organization, the number of landing craft. One of the reasons they couldn't do an earlier invasion across the channel in 1942 is they didn't have the landing craft. You have to have hundreds and hundreds of landing craft because all at once you're trying to put significant numbers of troops on a beach, on a hostile beach.
Oh, I mean, and they literally hadn't had them built.
It's actually a real problem.
You're doing them two dozen in one landing craft at a time, it's going to take a zillion
of them. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. You have to have as many land at once as you can. You can't string it out over several days because the first guys would be slaughtered and you wouldn't establish a beachhead.
Yeah, which is the absolute essential thing.
So there are all of these preparations involved. Logistics are a nightmare. All the supplies that have to be put in place, et cetera. Not all of this goes well. I should mention the infamous Slapton Sands disaster.
Yeah, we often read about that in passing in a lot of, and you see it in some documentary things, but people don't explain
it. Paul Fussell writes a lot about this because he's a big debunker. This was in Devon in April 1944. There's a large scale rehearsal, sort of a practice landing, amphibious landing, very large scale.
And Southwest England.
England. Unfortunately, while this was underway, some German E-boats, they're sort of like PT boats, these very small, fast sort of raiding craft, showed up and attacked this practice landing underway. 750 GIs were killed.
Oh.
So really bad thing. And
in an exercise.
Covered up at the time.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
Because this was really embarrassing. And this was not revealed until after the war.
When you, and the Allies presumably don't want the Germans to want other people to know that they're practicing because right. they're that would exactly. have tipping yeah, their hand.
They're, from their standpoint, there are lots of reasons to keep this covered up, but partly for public relations. You don't
yeah,
want to admit
yeah,
that
sure.
you don't, yeah. you don't want to admit that your carelessness got 750 guys killed before they even got into combat.
Ugh.
Yeah, that's very, very nasty event. Preparation Overlord also included the so-called transportation plan.
Yeah, what is this? This is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, that is it's not in the title does not give away what's going on
yeah,
here.
Exactly.
It's like
yeah.
what they're all going to like go for a ride in the country.
yeah, so yeah.
Transportation plan. This is the shifting of strategic bombing resources from bombing German cities and German industry to bombing the transportation network in France.
Okay.
Because planners understand that even if you get a toehold with your invasion force,
yeah.
it's a race. You're going to build up on the beach and in the beach area.
Yeah.
The Germans are going to rush their reinforcements to the area in an effort to drive you back into the sea.
Sure.
Which
sure.
almost happened at Salerno in September 1943, by the way. Right. The Germans came very close right. to crushing that invasion.
In Italy,
because,
yeah.
Because the defenders have all the advantage. Once they realize where you're landing, they can rush all the reinforcements yeah. to that spot, and you're weak and they're strong, and they can crush you. Mm-hmm. They actually in Salerno, they actually stopped a German armored assault a few hundred yards from the beach.
Wow.
That was really close. So they don't want that to happen again. And so what you do is you make it so the Germans can't rush stuff to the invasion area. And so they, for huh. months, well, weeks, they systematically bomb the French transportation network, marshaling yards, bridges,
right.
railroad lines. So the Germans' mobility is greatly reduced. By the way, lots of French civilians
well,
killed.
Well, that's to say, you're bombing your own
yeah,
allied civilians.
Yeah. Lots of French, this is before the invasion, it gets even worse after the invasion, but before the invasion, you have lots of French civilians losing their lives. It's perfectly justifiable. This was
sure,
a very,
has to
this
be
very
done,
sound
yeah.
plan, very strategically sound, and made a major contribution. But what's interesting is the leaders of the Allied air campaign, especially Bomber Harris, head of RAF Bomber Command,
yeah.
had to be dragged kicking and screaming to give up their aircraft for this purpose.
Oh, they wanted to stick with the German cities.
If you had left them to their own devices, they would have said, no, you can't have our aircraft for this purpose. We're going to continue to bomb German industry. That's how we win the war.
Oh, that's fascinating. And but also by doing this, by bombing French transportation hubs and railway yards and switching stations and things like that in France, aren't you also kind of tipping your hand that, well, A, we're going to land here, but also we're going to land here pretty soon because
that's
we're trying to do-
excellent question, and that's one of the reasons why they bomb so widely.
Oh, okay.
In other words, they don't just bomb the railway lines leading into Normandy. They
yeah,
target the entire transportation network across all of northern France. So it doesn't, this is an excellent question, but it doesn't sufficiently tip their hand. The Germans, by the way, the Germans know an invasion
is
coming.
Yeah, yeah.
They just don't
know
where, and they don't know when.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then there's, we mentioned this in the Patton episode, I believe. There's Operation Fortitude. One of the reasons this works is that the Allies also have this massive deception plan where they create a fake army group.
Yes, that's right. That's
the first
right.
U.S. Army
great.
Group,
yeah.
which exists only yeah. on paper. You can go online, see all sorts of photographs of inflatable tanks.
Yeah, yeah, they're great.
Which, at a distance, look like the real thing.
Sure, especially from the air.
A huge amount of fake radio traffic, enormous barbed wire enclosures with hundreds and hundreds of empty tents. They turn German agents. They do a really effective job, in retrospect, a really effective job of making the Germans think that the real invasion is coming at the Pas-de-Calais.
Yeah, they even have dummies out, on exercise yards. It makes it look like there's a whole regiment.
They detail a few GIs with guard dogs to
right,
walk
to make
outside.
It look as if, yeah,
outside, so that any German spies or any people collecting intelligence say, "Wow, what's going on here?"
Yeah.
So there's this massive complex of sort of infrastructure which is completely hollow.
Wow.
And you put a plausible person like Patton in charge, and it seems like. By the way, this deception plan is so good it even works after D-Day.
Oh, they think another range is coming.
They
okay.
think the D-Day, Hitler himself, they think the D-Day is a diversion, which is
holy
hilarious.
Cow.
And that it's actually important because when after June 6th, the Germans should be rushing everything that they can to Normandy, and they don't. They keep stuff in the Pas-de-Calais because of Operation Fortitude. It's one of the great deception successes of the Second World War.
And that's not necessarily German being dummkopfs. That's not a bad strategic decision either.
Yeah, lots of reasonable people would have been snowed by that.
Yeah.
Part of it also is their Allies are taking advantage of how bad German intelligence was.
Okay, yeah.
And it also happens to do with the control of the air. The Germans have no reconnaissance flights over England, so they have no idea what's going on the ground from the air. A lot of their bad intelligence network is worse because a lot of those agents have been turned.
Yeah.
In other words, they've been captured and put to use by the Allies to spread disinformation. So it's
again, busting another part of the myth that the German military efficiency is better than anyone else in the world.
On both fronts, yeah. One of the great flaws in the German war effort.
Yeah.
Poor intelligence and also just the devaluation of intelligence.
Yeah, your average really odd. Yeah.
Your average German army officer didn't fully grasp how important intelligence is, which is just amazing. You're right. Yeah, they have this reputation for being super efficient in all realms. Absolutely not. It probably didn't help, by the way, that the German Abwehr, their counterintelligence, was led by people who were plotting to kill Hitler.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm thinking they might have dragged their feet in some of their office work.
Talk about complications.
Yeah. But there are other German problems. Not only are they spread thin, in a place like Normandy, a lot of the German divisions defending the Atlantic coast are very poor quality divisions.
Oh, okay.
The Germans have a standard infantry division, which is quite good. By this point, defending some of the beaches, they've got these things called, they're called static divisions.
Right.
Static, in other words, they're really not able to move. They have no no motor transport. They're very weak. And a lot of them are staffed by these so-called East Battalions or Ostbataillonen.
Right.
These are a lot of soldiers that the Germans captured from the Red Army.
And turned them.
Well, we may have talked about them in the earlier episode. On the Eastern Front, there are a lot of these guys called Hivis or Hilfswilliger. They're Russian volunteers working for the German army in a non-combat capacity to free up Germans to fight in combat.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're doing it because they don't want to die in a German POW camp,
sure, yeah.
Which is what otherwise they're looking at, either dying of starvation or disease or being worked to death. And so some of them actually end up in combat units. And the way it is that they are in combat and behind them is a German non-commissioned officer with a submachine gun just to make sure everyone does their
fires
job,
in the right direction.
Fires in the right direction, doesn't run away, etc. Well, these are not the most motivated soldiers in the Wehrmacht, as you might imagine. Yeah. A lot of them are going to be relatively quick to surrender once the landing takes place.
Sure, yeah.
So the Germans have a lot of problems, some of which don't get a lot of notice. I have to draw attention to one of these soldiers, by the way, in one of these East battalions. Who's captured either on D-Day or a couple of days after D-Day. His name is Yang Kyung-jung.
Yang Kyung-jung?
Yeah, not the name you'd expect.
Not the most German name I've ever heard.
In fact, not even the most Russian name.
No.
And by the way, when D-Day takes place, a lot of Americans and British soldiers are floored because they start taking prisoners and these people don't speak German.
That's like, yeah, right.
Okay. What the hell's going on? This guy speaks Russian. This guy speaks Polish. This guy speaks Ukrainian. What's going on? They also capture some guys who are Asian.
Hey, wow.
Including this guy, Yang Kyung-jung. I'll just touch on it because we might want to go into this later into greater depth.
Yeah.
He was a very young man. He was he's Korean. Because Korea was controlled by Japan after 1910, he was drafted into the Japanese army.
So he's Axis. Technically, he's Axis, yeah.
He's in the Japanese army in 1939 when the Japanese have their famous border war against the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
A Khalkhin goal. This is summer 1939, where Marshal Zhukov first earns his stripes.
Hmm.
The Japanese are badly mauled, by the way, in this border conflict. And Yang Kyung-jung, as a ethnic Korean Japanese soldier, is captured by the Russians and sent to a prison camp. After 1941, when the Germans invade, he's taken out of that prison camp and put in the Red Army. So now he's a Korean fighting.
Double capture.
It gets better.
Oh, Lordy.
He's fighting for the Red Army against the Germans. The Germans capture him. And he ends up in the Wehrmacht defending Omaha Beach, where he's captured by the Americans. And he ends up settling in the United States, where he lived happily
after the war.
Where he lived happily ever after. He kind of did the World War II world tour.
Yeah, and did it from east to west.
East to west.
Wow.
Now, this story is not typical.
No.
But they may have actually, I haven't seen it, but I'm pretty sure they made a movie about him.
No, well, they have to.
Because it's an amazing
too good.
Story. How
too
many
good
people served
to.
In the Japanese, the Soviet, the German army during World War II and survived?
Survived, that's right.
Survived. Talk about winning the lottery. Yeah. We're going to put you in these three armies where there's a very high chance you're going to be killed or wounded. And he's
boy, if he didn't write his memoirs, he certainly missed a trick.
Absolutely.
That's
the kind of story. It's like, really? Well, yeah, really. Anyway, there were obviously enormous risks involved in the Overlord operation. Eisenhower himself famously wrote in advance of the landing, wrote basically a concession speech. where he basically takes the blame for the failure of the invasion. He had that memo. It's pretty famous. He had that memo ready to go.
Oh my goodness.
Because the odds were so long, right? This is by far the largest amphibious invasion ever attempted. There had been other amphibious invasions, some of them relatively large, not on this scale. This is basically 5 invasion beaches, which I'll say more about in a minute.
Yeah.
Multiple divisions.
Now, was Eisenhower going to resign if it didn't work, or just take the blame?
Just take the blame.
Okay, all right.
Just take the blame. Yeah. This is all on me. You know, we did our best. This is a difficult undertaking, and it didn't work out.
Boy, but to be prepared for that is...
There are lots of risks. One of the risks is, despite your intelligence superiority, is always a risk that the Germans will find out when you're landing and where, mm-hmm. right? And you always, and you, that's the kind of thing you wouldn't find out until the invasion starts. And it's like, oh, wow, they have all their strength concentrated where they're not supposed to be. And now we're going to get hammered.
Yeah.
I have to tell you this other anecdote. This is in April and May 1944. There was a British newspaper that... like most newspapers, regularly printed a crossword puzzle.
Yeah.
And they had a crossword puzzle a few weeks before D-Day. And so the answers to a lot of the questions were words like Overlord, Neptune, Juno. In other words, really weird choices. And Allied intelligence freaked out. And they swooped in on the editorial offices of this British newspaper, convinced that the editor was like a German spy and was using the crossword puzzle
communicate. And it was just coincidence?
It was pure coincidence. This guy was dragged into interrogation. He's like, what have I done?
Can you imagine they would freak, though? They'd freak if they saw it.
Total luck. But yeah, but Allied intelligence had this brief moment of panic, like the jig is up.
Wow.
A word like Overlord, right? How often is that going to show up in a crossword puzzle? It seemed like a really weird coincidence. And that was not the only word like that in the puzzle.
Well, speaking of code words and the use of code words, we should take a break here and go down to the advertising department and hear from our sponsors, Harry's Razors, where you can use the code word, wait for it, buzzkill, in a special way.
Wait, not Overlord?
Not Overlord. To get yourself a fantastic new shaving life. Back in a minute, buzzkillers. Help me out, buzzkillers. Lady Buzzkill is on my case. She keeps telling me that I'm not enthusiastic enough, that I'm not convincing enough when I try to tell you about how wonderful Harry's Razors are. I know you can't see me out there in podcast land, buzzkillers, but I assure you that I look and I feel fantastic. That's because I use Harry's Razors to fuzz kill unsightly stubble, save time and money at the same time. You know, it's been centuries, since big rip-off razor companies have been dominating the market, ripping us off with their newest versions. They raise their already high prices. So two good buzz killers, Jeff and Andy, went out and founded their own razor company. They did it the smart way. They went and bought a razor factory in Germany. They make their own razors blades themselves. They still just charge $2 per blade compared to the $4 you've been paying for 400 years to rip off razor companies. And they ship them right to you. They cut out the middleman. It's perfect. And what's even more perfect is the razors themselves. Of course, they have the soft flex hinge that you know I talk about all the time. The trimmer blade to get those little stubbles from around your nose and other places, and to trim your beard if you've got one. Again, Abraham Lincoln used that. A lubricating strip to keep everything nice and smooth. And the best part, in my view, is the angle of the razor blades. It's better. It's just better. I can't explain it scientifically. I just know it is because my shaving life is so much more improved. When you sign up for Harry's, they mail the razors right to you on a regular schedule so that you're never left looking bad or feeling bad. And as you know, Harry's has a special offer just for the listeners of this podcast. If you go to harrys.com and enter the code BUZZKILL, BUZZKILL, at checkout, you'll get the Great Razor 5-blade cartridge, their shaving gel, which is the best in the world, and soothing post-shave balm for free. For free! You only have to pay a little bit for shipping. It's only $3. You'll look great, and your face will feel great all day, even if you're only heard and not seen, like me. Okay, we're back, buzzkillers. Now, of course, you're back from the internet, having put in your special code word, buzzkill, to get that discount at Harry's and to start a whole new outlook on life. But we just left you at the point at which the whole sort of secrecy and paranoia and fear about D-Day being exposed to the enemy was going on in British intelligence and the Allied forces. So We're at the cliffhanger. So now.
So now what happens? Well, the invasion starts on June 5th, technically, because that's when there are these airborne landings. The Allies, by this point, have built up a significant, first of its kind in history, a significant airborne force, multiple airborne divisions, right? The divisions that are landed behind enemy lines by airplane and parachute.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the idea is that in conjunction, just before the invasion, to secure the flanks of the invasion area, they would drop two American divisions, the 82nd and the 101st, and over on the British side, the British 6th Airborne Division, to drop these in the night before. And this was also incredibly risky. I encourage people to go watch, once again, Band of Brothers, which talks about one unit of the 101st Airborne, because this is a landing. This is very early in the history of airborne landings.
And parachuting.
Very primitive conditions. And this is at night.
Yeah, I can't imagine parachuting.
It's a lot of these planes are shot down. A lot of them they drop their airborne forces into the ocean or into the swamps, or they get land in trees, or they land directly on German units and get shot while they're in the air. It could have been much worse. And in some ways, the fact that these airborne forces were scattered all over the place, especially on the American side, the British drop was more concentrated, partly because it relied more heavily on gliders, I think. They also, the British are actually seizing these bridges across a canal so that that their flank is not hemmed in by this canal. They land a glider 50 feet from the objective at night, which is, I'm pretty sure has astounding. Never ever been equaled. They get out of the glider and shoot the Germans at the bridge and take the bridge.
I mean,
a textbook. The Americans are much more scattered all over the place. This actually worked. Because when the Germans slowed down the German reaction, they didn't know what was going on. They didn't know what the objective was. They didn't know how to concentrate because they were getting reports of American paratroopers all over the place. And that's because they were all over the place.
Oh, so they can't pin it down to say, oh, here's the invasion coming right here.
Right, so this is a case where the landing doesn't go well, but in a way it actually works out. I mean, it was bad in other ways. It was difficult to concentrate. But the Germans were also snow. There was another deception. There were a couple points, especially on the American side, where the Americans dropped large numbers of these paratrooper dummies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a movie
called The Longest Day.
That's right. 1962, yeah. Which is the longest movie ever.
I'm with you. I'm not a very. Although I have to tell you this, I saw that once in a theater, and there were a bunch of other history geeks in the audience, and there's a point where Eddie Albert, who's an American,
he
gets killed, and there's, you know, the audience is pretty silent. And so one guy shouts out, "Green Acres bites the dust," which I thought was pretty hilarious. In any case, the movie's not very good, but they show they're about a quarter or a third size of a real paratrooper.
Oh, they're dummies. Yeah,
they're dummies. Right. They drop with a parachute, and they have firecrackers in them. From a distance, it looks like a real paratrooper, and they land, and then you hear all this, what appears to be gunfire.
Going off.
And that actually had an effect. There were German units that went on these sort of wild goose chases, thinking, oh, their paratroopers are dropped over here, and then they appear in this field, and they're all just dummies.
Okay, and from the ground, you can't tell
night,
that they
distance,
look like.
All you see is these parachutes.
Yeah.
You have no perspective, and so so that actually helped a little bit.
Yeah.
So those airborne landings, they do help. They help slow the German reaction to the beachheads. They go down in the lore of the British and the American paratrooper history.
Right, right.
Despite the relatively high casualties and the fact that this, you know, they're by the way, not only dropping at night, but with relatively high winds.
Oh.
And there's flak, and a lot of the pilots of the planes don't react well. Like, for example, they come under fire, and they order their troops out early.
Oh.
And it was before you've actually gotten to the drop zone.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, so there are lots of problems there.
But this sort of stuff, I mean, I hate to sound, this sounds unnecessarily, I mean, unduly pessimistic, but it's bound to happen.
Yeah.
Something
it's
this
called,
massive.
It's called friction.
And yeah.
Or the fog of war, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Things go wrong, especially, you know, and they're dropping under conditions. And by the way, after only, I heard this 82nd Airborne podcast the other day where they talked about this, that these days paratroopers have hundreds of jumps before they're considered ready. Back then, these guys had jumped maybe three or four times, and now they're jumping at night in high winds, which they would never do today, especially the high wind thing. Anyway, so then there are these five landing beaches from looking north from left to right. People have probably heard about these: Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. which are respectively American, American, British, Canadian, British.
Right.
Multiple divisions, right? I think it's 156,000 men landed on D-Day. Massive undertaking.
156,000?
Yeah, it's an enormous force. We will never, I'm pretty confident we will never see an amphibious invasion like that again.
Yeah. Well, there's a very big one in the Korean War, but not as big as
not
this.
Not nearly as big. Yeah. Overall, as we'll see, it goes pretty well. And much better than they expected.
Right.
Partly this is luck, and here's where the weather plays a role.
Oh.
Because you have to have good weather, obviously. You have to have good weather so that your planes can fly and protect your, you know, support the invasion, basically, and so that your paratrooper planes can fly.
Because in other, I mean, I'm sure buzzkillers know this, but it bears repeating. If you don't have anyone harassing the defending troops on the cliffs, you're a sitting duck on the beach.
Yes.
You're just
there's no cover,
a shooting range.
There's no cover. You have no room for maneuver. You can't bring all your force to bear because you're defending a beachhead that's only a couple hundred feet deep at first.
Right, right.
And as we'll see, this becomes a problem in Omaha. Weather's also a problem because in the English Channel, if you have bad weather, you have incredibly choppy sea.
All the time. Yeah, and it's frequent.
You're going to have boats that are swamped. The boats are not going to land where they're supposed to be, and that actually does happen. There's also other good luck, like on Utah Beach. Utah Beach is a relative cakewalk, partly because most of the landing craft land not where they're supposed to.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It just worked out. Had they landed as planned, they would have run into more opposition. They still would have prevailed.
Yeah.
They would have taken much higher casualties.
Oh.
Utah casualties were incredibly light.
Yeah.
There was also plenty of bad luck. I'm sure the listeners are anticipating. Anyway, I forgot to finish one thing about the weather is the weather was so bad early on that initially the invasion was planned for June 5th or 4th. I forget, one of those 2 days. And it was postponed.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In fact, that's how Band of Brothers, the invasion starts, is because they're ready to jump and they're told to stand down, 24-hour delay. And that was because the weather was so bad. But it turned out Eisenhower had, I think his last name is Stagg. He had a fabulous British meteorologist on his staff who confidently predicted that even though the weather is bad enough that we have to postpone the invasion, there's going to be a 36-hour break in the weather.
Oh, he was able to predict that ahead of time.
He was able to predict that. And remember, they don't have the same tools.
No.
For AccuWeather forecast. Yeah. So, and a lot of people are very nervous that what if this forecast is off by even 12 hours?
Oh, yeah.
But he's saying the weather's going to be good enough for 36 hours that we can pull off the invasion. That ends up working out really well because the weather's bad enough that people like Rommel, for example, think, oh, the weather's so bad, they couldn't possibly land in this. So the Germans sort of let their guard down. Rommel himself actually goes back to Germany for his wife's birthday.
Oh, wow.
And one of the reasons why their response is slow is that he is not on the scene to manage things. And
sure.
Because he and a lot of other people didn't think they would possibly land in such lousy weather.
Yeah, okay.
So that works out.
Is that your cake,
well.
Mrs. Rommel, or are you just happy to see me?
I'm sure that's exactly how it went down, by the way.
Yeah.
So there was lots of bad luck, and you see most of the bad luck on the Omaha Beach, the middle of the American beaches. This is a case where pretty much everything that could go wrong went wrong, and I'll just rattle off some of these things that went wrong.
Okay.
One is that the preparatory bombardment was not nearly as effective as they thought it was going to be. Neither the naval bombardment, right, the shelling of German positions, but naval gunfire.
Right, to knock them out.
Nor the aerial preparation, the sort of the bombing from the air.
Okay.
These pretty much did not affect the German defenses the way they were supposed to.
Right,
and it's really sad because all the forces landing in Omaha had essentially been told, you just walk up on the beach. Because there won't be any opposition. We will have blasted it all away
before
you arrive.
Oh, so Omaha wasn't predestined to be the hardest beach necessarily.
No. It was a combination.
Again, one of things I'd always thought.
Right. It was a combination of bad luck. Part of here was an intelligence failure. Allied intelligence was generally pretty good, and they missed the presence of a relatively good German division.
Okay.
Even not the entire division. And by the way, it could have been much worse. Because part of the division, in fact, I think an entire regiment of that German 352nd Division was spent D-Day further south looking for paratroopers and chasing paratrooper dummies.
Oh, okay. Well, there
so
you go.
It could have been worse, but there was one or two regiments that were on the beach and they caused devastating losses among the Americans.
Yeah.
Another problem is that they were inexperienced U.S. troops.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans landed parts of two divisions at Omaha. The mm-hmm. first, the so-called Big Red One, was very experienced. No problem there. But yeah. the other was the 29th Division, which was a new division. And it's not clear why Omar Bradley and other people insisted on landing a division that was not very experienced.
Now, when you say experienced, when the Big Red One is an experienced division, but on the other hand, there hadn't been an amphibious invasion like this. You mean they were experienced soldiers, but they hadn't necessarily done a lot of amphibious
correct,
invasions.
Correct,
but they'd been under fire.
They had been under fire a lot.
In fact, these other guys
had. The Big Red One okay. was one of the most experienced divisions in the entire American Army. They had fought in North Africa.
Okay.
They had fought in Italy, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So they're battle hardened. The 29th. Remember, the American Army is expanding very, very rapidly.
Yes, that's
and
right.
Divisions yeah. like the 29th. They just haven't been in combat. They're as well trained as anybody else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, and especially when things start to go wrong, we want a veteran division that knows how to handle itself. You're right. You're going to have fewer soldiers that will freeze. You'll have fewer
yeah.
soldiers that, you know, as we'll see in Omaha, it requires some individual initiative rather than just hunkering down and waiting for orders, that kind of thing.
That's right, right, right. Okay.
So
okay.
And that was not a decisive problem, but it was a contributing problem. So, and I urge people to watch the first 30 minutes of Saving Private Ryan if they want to get some idea of what Omaha Beach was like.
Oh, yeah.
And just how it's a sort of murderous fire that some of these landing craft ran into the minute they hit the beach.
And by the way, it's not just us saying that. You know, all sorts of D-Day experts, historians and other scholars and veterans talk about how realistically that was done.
Yep. Yeah. And it is brutal.
Usually we're very critical of the movies, but that's not
right.
one
and,
of those
and,
cases.
And generally that movie too. I'm not a big fan of that movie, but the first part of the movie gives you about as good a sense as you could get of what Omaha Beach was like. There are other problems. The Allies at multiple beaches had these things called DD tanks. They were duplex drive. They would take a Sherman tank and they'd fit it with this collapsible canvas skirt.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps water out,
mm-hmm.
and then they attach this sort of external propeller to the drive shaft. And so you can actually launch this tank in water as long as the water is relatively shallow and calm, and then it will drive up on the beach, and then you lower the canvas thing and you go into combat.
Yeah.
At Omaha, they had 32 of these tanks. The problem was they launched them way too far out at sea. Five of them made it to the beach.
Yeah, they sank.
And some of the crews drowned, actually.
Ugh,
some of them managed to escape, but they basically started to take on too much water.
Must have been horrific.
Yeah. And there were other problems like the coxswains who are driving these landing craft. A lot of them, they don't pull far enough up on the beach. They get sort of freaked out by all the incoming gunfire and artillery fire. And they don't do their jobs properly. A lot of the soldiers are, in retrospect, way too heavily equipped. You know, they're equipped more like paratroopers than regular soldiers. In other words, they're carrying basically like try to imagine some contingency and then give the person a piece of equipment for that. Right. Load them down with grenades and ammunition and 3 days worth of food. And, you know, so in other words, you're struggling out of a landing craft, probably good chance into waist deep water. And you've got 60, 80, 100 pounds of equipment.
Yeah.
Speed is useful in running across the beach.
Yeah,
and none
absolutely.
Of these guys, a lot of them are exhausted the minute they hit sand.
Yeah.
Some of them had been struggling through water. Some of them drowned, by the way.
Yeah.
Because once your landing craft comes under fire, you're urged to get over the side of the landing craft.
Oh, okay.
So landing craft hit a sandbar or the ramp was lowered too early.
And your pack is heavy.
Your pack could kill you, pretty much.
Ugh.
So this happened in some cases. So a lot of these troops are exhausted and, you know, they spend maybe half an hour just recovering from having landed, whereas you're supposed to rush right into combat.
Yeah. And while you're recovering, you're sitting duck.
So these are, this is like these accumulated little problems all start to pile up on Omaha. Omaha ultimately works out, but Omar Bradley, who's commander of the American landing force, he, in the first hour or two, he seriously contemplates canceling the Omaha invasion. Because the problem is...
Oh, no kidding.
This all has to go according to plan. The first wave has to land and move inland to create space on the beach for the second wave.
Yeah.
The engineers have to blow up a certain number of the beach obstacles.
Yeah.
So that the other bigger landing craft and the second wave can land. And that wasn't possible.
And otherwise, then they're stuck out in the channel and also capably shelled.
You have cases where the soldiers who are luckily alive are cowering behind these landing obstacles.
Yeah.
And our engineers with their explosives are screaming at them, you need to clear away so I can blow up this obstacle.
And the obstacle's saving my life.
And the beach is total chaos. It's being swept by fire. It's too crowded. You've got wounded men all over the place. You've got equipment. You've got people sort of digging holes for themselves, trying to survive.
Yeah.
And it's just a complete nightmare.
And it's amazing this doesn't happen at Utah. It doesn't happen. Even though the other beaches are different, it is amazing it doesn't happen at every beach as a matter of course because it is a beach.
And that's the amazing thing. The figure I saw, I believe at Omaha, the Allies suffer about 10% casualties.
Wow.
Which is very high.
Yeah.
But if you look at the planning for D-Day, the planners, including, I think, Churchill, expected 10% casualties overall. In other words, they expected every beach to be as costly as Omaha. And that was part of the plan. So the good news is 4 out of 5 beaches were much, much better.
Okay, okay.
Incomparably better in terms of casualties than Omaha was.
Okay.
So ultimately they prevail. Won't go into all the details. Some reasons for the Allied success at the end of the day, they did successfully. And by the way, cancellation of Omaha would have been a big problem because then you would have had Utah Beach off to the side, not connected to the other invasion beaches.
Oh, exactly, because it would be this big German...
Yeah, and the Germans would exploit that gap and use it to attack the other beaches from the side.
Ugh.
So you do really have to have one continuous beachhead, ideally. So canceling Omaha would have been a problem. A couple hours, I think by maybe 7:30, 8:30 a.m., Bradley sees enough minimal progress that he continues to double down on Omaha rather than canceling it.
Ugh.
So that doesn't,
and they still got a full day of nasty fighting to do.
That's right. So why did the Allies succeed ultimately? One of the factors certainly is air superiority.
Yeah.
The figure I've seen is that the Allies over the Normandy beachhead on D-Day had 12,000 aircraft in the air.
12,000?
12,000 of various types. The Luftwaffe did show up, and this is actually shown in the movie Longest Day.
Yeah.
The Luftwaffe made a single pass with 2 Messerschmitts.
Yeah.
And I would love to have talked to one of those German pilots.
Yeah, they must
It's like, okay, we did a strafing run. Now we're going to get out of Dodge because the odds are 12,000 to 2. Yeah. So.
Hashtag failing Luftwaffe. Exactly. Sad.
Sad. So much fail up in that Luftwaffe right there. And that's because, I mean, they've win. This is an indirect effect of the strategic bombing. Luftwaffe has been systematically withdrawn to defend Germany and does not have a presence over the beach.
Yeah.
So in the air, the landing is virtually uncontested.
Wow.
And so then the Americans and the British can start flying air support missions to support the establishment and the expansion of the beachhead.
And of course, as you said before, the bombing of the transportation hubs and the transportation crossroads
even though
it might not have seemed that like it was going to pay off earlier.
Right, especially in the weeks afterwards.
The German
response is going to be very slow, including some divisions forced to converge on Normandy by foot.
Oh, yeah.
Which is extremely slow, and
it
takes them days or weeks when it should have taken them no time at all. So the transportation plan helped pay off. Fortitude and the other ruses like the dummy paratroopers, those also help the success. The weather, big factor in the success, and obviously you can plan for that a little bit, but that was partly luck.
Do we know whether that weatherman got a medal or some sort of major promotion?
I don't know that. If he didn't, he should have.
We should check into him.
Because I realize we don't normally use the phrase badass meteorologist. but that's what he was.
Well, if you're mentioned by Eisenhower, who was pretty
stag, had some swag, I think is what I'm going to say. He did a terrific job.
Go to the Buzzkill bookshelf and you'll be able to buy souvenirs, t-shirts with Stag has some swag.
Stag swag. And by the way, it's actually amazing, even more to the point, because in terms of the tides and the right moon in the sky, etc., if you didn't land on June 6th, you would have had to wait for the next correct sort of assembly of, or it's a combination of tide and moon, which would have been around June 18th. On June 18th, there was a historically bad gale in the English Channel that probably would have wiped out the invasion force.
Wow. So this stag guy was, he was not only a badass meteorologist, but he was a swami. He was able to look into the future.
Like, you know, that next storm's going to be a doozy. I don't think he predicted that one, but that's the one that you may have heard of, these artificial harbors called mulberries, which is
we're going to talk about it later.
One of those was completely wiped out, and the other one was badly damaged in that gale, which landing in that would have been horrible. In any case, one of the big contributors is improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
Especially on Omaha. If you read about Omaha, Omaha is won by scratch units. In other words, an individual sergeant, an individual lieutenant, gathering the troops around him and saying, look, we need to get off the beach or you're going to die. And attacking in little penny packets. All the plan goes out the window. You make your way forward. You make your way up the cliff.
And what does penny packet mean?
Small groups of guys.
Okay. Okay.
Right? In other words, fighting the way paratroopers are sometimes supposed to fight.
All right.
You've got to be flexible. You've got to show initiative. The plan has gone out the window. You're being commanded by an officer you don't even know, because all the units are all mixed up because they've all landed on each other's beaches. You know, if you know the guy next to you, that's a big plus. And so you're just, and then they slowly, very slowly over the course of the day and into the afternoon, work their way up the bluff, start taking out individual German machine gun nests, throwing grenades into individual bunkers, and ultimately get to the top of the bluff and then start to work their way inland. If you look at the map at the end of first day of D-Day, the Omaha beachhead is by far the smallest.
I think it's
only like a mile deep and maybe a mile wide, more or less. It's just super small. They did not reach their D-Day objectives, but they have a toehold. And they did it because of improvisation. Right. It also helped.
But by the way, that's another very accurate portrayal in Saving Private Ryan, how this Berenger grabs a bunch of guys and says, you go then do this.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was Tom Berenger.
No,
sorry
Tom
if he's not.
Tom Hanks.
No, but there's another guy. There's another minor
The sergeant.
Ranking
I think it's
guy.
Tom Sizemore.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
No, not Tom Berenger.
Well, apologies to all you Hollywood types out there.
He got that wrong.
Yeah.
It's not a mistake if we catch it. What a big help on Omaha also was the U.S. Navy in the form of their destroyers, not only U.S. destroyers, but British and other destroyers, who came in very, very close to the beach. So, in other words, closer to the beach than you're supposed to. They threw out the naval regulations because if you come in too close, you risk running aground.
Yeah.
And if you run aground, you're toast because then German artillery can zero in on you, right? The destroyers have to be mobile. They have to be moving back and forth.
Kill hundreds of guys in one.
They risked running aground to come in close enough to deliver accurate supporting naval gunfire, which really helped turn the tide on Omaha. In other words, the sort of bombardment that was supposed to happen beforehand happens during, because these destroyers firing their 5-inch guns and taking out German positions with amazing accuracy because they're in so close. And so that was really well done and a nice little sort of potential sacrifice.
And by the way, this is an extremely dramatic and amazing thing, but can you imagine being an Allied soldier attacking the beach, and not only are you being fired at by the Germans, but there are your own naval guns right behind you firing just over your heads?
Right.
I mean, it must have felt like a hell sandwich. You know,
well, and that's one of the reasons why some of the aerial support is not as effective, is that a lot of the bombs don't, in their fear of bombing their own troops, they bomb too far inland. And a lot of the bombs hit nothing.
Yeah, farms.
That becomes an issue too. But for the entire Normandy campaign, if you sort of zoom out a little bit and look at the larger campaign, which lasts months, the Allies don't break out.
Forget about that. Yeah.
There's this huge stalemate in Normandy afterwards. The bridgehead is successfully expanded, and they're not in danger of being driven back into the sea, but the Normandy campaign in June and July is a real slugfest, and they don't break out of the Normandy beachhead until end of July, and then the German front collapses in August.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it's really a war of attrition. It's not superior tactics. Certainly, it's not superior generalship. Certainly not on the Allied side.
Right.
The Germans are basically ground down, and partly because of the transportation plan and the ongoing Allied command of the air. And also the Germans are being stretched too thin. The Germans just don't have the manpower.
Sure.
In the whole of the Normandy campaign, so June, July, August 1944, in Normandy, the Germans suffered between 400,000 and 500,000 casualties. That's killed, wounded, missing.
Yeah.
That includes prisoners as well. during that time, they bring up 20,000 replacements.
Nothing.
So it's sort of like El Alamein. That's a number. It's a numbers battle that they are losing very, very badly.
Wow.
Because what they're up against a constantly expanding British and American and Canadian and Polish and French force, which just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
They're up against more and more fresh units, more and more Allied reinforcements, more and more American and British firepower among all else. Rommel is constantly blown away by the amount of just materiel the Allies have.
Yeah.
It's like the Germans at a certain point can't use their artillery anymore. They're running out of shells, whereas the Allied shells just keep coming over endlessly.
And even then, it still takes almost a year to get to Berlin.
I mean, right.
The whole thing, the 44 and 45, just amazing.
Oh, yeah. The scale is insane. But, the Germans are hard-pressed. They, at a certain point, their mobile units, their panzer units, which are supposed to be behind the line as a mobile reserve to react to breakthroughs and plug holes.
Yeah.
They're in the line as well. That's how and then what that means is when the Americans finally break through on their sector, the Operation Cobra, end of July 1944, by that point the Germans are at the end of their reserves and their line is very brittle and there's no, the Americans break through and then for once they're not met by this immediate German counterattack, which is German doctrine and always drives the Allies nuts.
Yeah.
They take an objective and then it's retaken by the Germans because the German doctrine is to counterattack immediately. No counterattack comes and the Americans are like,
This might be a sign of things to come.
In other words, we've broken through and there's no one plugging the hole. And then the German, on the western side of the front, the German front collapses and becomes a rout.
And that's when Rommel must have really realized it's over.
Actually, by that point, he's out of action because he's been wounded.
Oh, that's right. He
personally experiences Allied command of the air when his command car is shot up by a British Spitfire.
Yeah.
So more specifically, Allied numbers, firepower, and air resources overcome the German advantages. And the Germans do have advantages.
Yeah. Well, they've been there for a long time, first of all.
The German soldiers are probably the best trained in the world. Mm-hmm. The terrain, especially on the American sector, the bocage, the hedgerows of the Norman countryside, their tactical prowess. They've got some extremely good units, like we mentioned the Hitler Youth, Youth Division, the 12th SS Panzer Division, which basically fights on until it no longer exists. So the Germans do have some advantages, but those advantages are eclipsed by the Allies' own advantages, basically.
And this, what's so fascinating about this and about this episode and about this, the whole D-Day thing is, it's such a big deal, not only strategically and logistically and project management, if you will. Sorry to use such a shallow term for it, but we've only just started now to talk about the historical complications and the historical significance of all this. The whole myths of D-Day are almost as big as D-Day itself. But before we do that, we need to take another break to hear from another one of our partners. And so it's down to the sponsorship division in the Buzzkill Institute, and we'll be back in a moment. Buzzkillers, are you aware that global hygiene is in your hands? Well, the people at Eco Soap Bank are aware of it. Clean water, proper sanitation, and personal cleanliness are among the most important factors in keeping poor families healthy in the developing world. Yet 75% of rural families in Cambodia, specifically, lack access to the most basic hygiene products, including soap. So our partners at Eco Soap Bank are doing something about it. They work with hotels and guest houses in Cambodia to collect the partially used bars of soap left behind by the estimated 3 to 4 million tourists that pass through the country each year. The discarded non-biodegradable soap bars are purified and recycled into new soap bars that are then distributed to rural schools, clinics, and slum areas. To date, the Eco Soap Bank has recycled 26,000 pounds of soap and served 666,562 people through its distribution program and its hygiene classes. And the Buzzkill Institute is committed to helping this great project by contributing $1 for every Buzzkiller who donates to the Eco Soap Bank. Go to ecosoapbank.org/donate and type Buzzkill in the comments section of the online donation form. A donation of just $25 provides soap and hygiene education for 250 Cambodians and recycles 35 pounds of soap from the hospitality industry. And of course, it supports ongoing employment of local people in Cambodia. It's as easy as that, Buzzkillers. A simple act to fill a basic need. Please donate. Okay, we're back upstairs, Buzzkillers. And as we said, that there's so much about D-Day and it's so large. And the myths about D-Day are so large, Professor. I mean, it's fascinating how they just on and on and on.
Sure. Let me start with can I insert a mini myth in the middle of a larger show? Is that okay? Am I misusing the terminology?
There's
a mini myth. There are these things, they're kind of famous in the history of D-Day. They were called mulberries.
Yeah.
The problem in Normandy is once you're established, you have to funnel all these reinforcements and supplies and ammunition onto a beach. There's no harbor there.
Yeah.
And that's very inefficient. So what the Allies do is they come up with the idea of these mulberries. They're basically large artificial harbors, which are towed across the channel in pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And then put in and stitched together. And basically, so now you build off of the beach, you build a harbor. They also, by the way, had, it was called Pluto. It's an acronym. They lay pipeline under the English Channel so that oil and gasoline were pumped directly across from pumping stations in Britain.
Just
Normandy.
The infrastructure that we don't never think
Absolutely.
About.
The infrastructure is amazing. Anyway, I think these mulberries, because it's a good story, I think sometimes their contribution is hyped a little bit.
Okay, so they're important.
They're important, but they're not decisive. And if you look at the flow of supplies and how they got there and how they got there and in what quantity, the mulberries, they were certainly an engineering wonder, especially at the time, but they were not decisive.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, that's just like maybe not even a mini myth, a mini myth, a much bigger myth. And I was reminded of this the other day because I was previewing a video to show my students, and a relatively major historian who shall remain nameless again described the D-Day, the Overlord invasion, as a turning point in the war.
Okay.
I would dispute that, and I think most World War II historians would as well. And this is important. I am not at all minimizing the sacrifice, the magnitude, the importance of D-Day. D-Day was important. It is important in contributing to the German defeat.
Uh-huh.
But to talk about D-Day as a turning point, which suggests to me that the Allies aren't winning before it and then are winning after it.
Right. Okay. So, yeah. So,
not a turning point.
Okay.
Germany was already clearly losing World War II on June 5th, 1944.
Okay.
As of. It was not the turning point.
Is it an accelerating factor?
It's definitely an accelerating factor. No question. Certainly hastened Germany's collapse. If you counterfactually remove the Overlord invasion, Germany probably can fight on longer.
Yeah. All the way to the end of 45, into 46?
Maybe. I mean, there are so many what ifs.
Because
we'd probably be using atomic bombs on Berlin, for example.
Right?
I mean, there are lots of... The what if game gets complicated very quickly. I'm just putting it in perspective, and if you look at Germany's strategic situation on June 5th, 1944, they are already losing. And shortly thereafter, they start losing even more quickly, and not just because of D-Day.
Right.
And once again here, the often overlooked Eastern Front plays a big role. On June 22nd...
Two weeks
after D-Day, June 22nd, and not coincidentally, the third anniversary of the German invasion of the Soviet Union, the Russians launched their Operation Bagration. It's named after not a communist, but a Napoleonic Wars hero.
Oh, that's interesting that they would have dragged that up. But of course, it's the same thing. It's a German thing.
The Soviets are... they're pushing the patriotic nationalist buttons, not the international communist buttons.
There's
a lot of that going on. And by the way, Bagration was also a Georgian, just like Stalin was. Not a coincidence. Anyway, who cares why it was named what it was named. But anyway, between June and September 1944, the Soviets launch a massive, and I mean massive, offensive against the German Army Group Center. So this is in the center of the Eastern Front. Pretty much, if you draw a line between Warsaw and Moscow, it's in that area.
Oh, right. Okay.
The Western Soviet Union, near cities like Minsk.
Yeah.
A lot of it's in Belarusia. This is a huge offensive against the Germans. The Germans are caught completely by surprise, largely because of Soviet, what they called maskarovka, their own deception. They've completely fake out the Germans, make the Germans think they're going to attack in the south and not in the center.
Huh.
Germans are caught off guard. About the Germans in this offensive, which lasts a few months, the Germans lose about 400,000 casualties, which is roughly the same casualties as they lose in Normandy.
Oh, yeah, because it's 400,000, 500,000.
These are worse losses than the Germans suffer at Stalingrad.
Oh, what you hear about all the time, but you never hear about.
Which is usually pointed to as a turning point, and for good reason.
Yeah, sure.
But in terms of losses, this is devastating to the Germans. This offensive carries the Red Army all the way to Warsaw.
Yeah, and it's happening in the same summer as D-Day.
It greatly complicates Germany's strategic problem because they're running out of reserves. They're spread too thin. They if they take troops out of Normandy and send them to the Eastern Front, then Normandy collapses. Right? They're trying to play whack-a-mole, basically.
Yeah,
And failing. If you look at the distribution of German divisions, you can find this online, and this to me is very telling. In other words, the way German units, German divisions, which is the basic building block, right, between 12 and 20,000 men of any army, the way they're spread around, May 1944, the Germans have 160 divisions in the east and 63 divisions in the west. In other words, part of their Atlantic wall, right, trying to anticipate D-Day. Okay, and there are other units otherwise. They have some in Norway. They have 12 divisions in Norway. They have 8 in Finland. They have 24 in the Balkans, fighting against Yugoslavian partisans, for example. They have 23 divisions in Italy, for a total of 291.
Yeah.
So May 1944, there are 160 out of 291 divisions are in the Eastern Front, which gives you
a hell of a lot.
And we've talked about this before, but that shows you, remember, 3/4 of their casualties are going to be in the Eastern Front. That's why the Eastern Front is so important. And that's where they lose the war. Vast majority of their divisions are on the Eastern Front. If you fast forward to September 1944, after the collapse of the front in Normandy, and Paris is liberated August 25th, 1944, for example, after the few months of the Bagration offensive, the balance is 127 divisions in the east and 64 in the west.
Twice as many.
Right, but look what's happened. 160 has dropped to 127. That's how many divisions have been chewed up in Bagration. And the number in the west has remained static. So in this one measure, and this is not the only relevant measure, but in one measure, you look at the relative magnitude in terms of what the strategic problem for the Germans is that they're, you can argue that it's the Eastern Front
that's
where they are suffering more heavily.
Yeah.
Than the Western Front. Now,
and constant is because it's going on since Stalingrad is 43.
Right, exactly. And they're being pushed back because they're being overwhelmed. But like we said before, not just because of numbers, because the Russians are fighting better. The Russians can pursue because they have all the American Lend-Lease, 2.5-ton trucks, et cetera. So in other words, and the argument isn't here to say, well, who's more responsible for winning World War II? You know, you're not as important as I am. And that's not the point. The point is to stress the interconnectedness of the fronts.
Okay.
You know, and if you go to the bookstore, you see a lot of books on D-Day, and you don't see very many books about Bagration, right? And I would argue that that balance needs to be evened out, and because those fronts are interconnected. By the way, you already saw this in 1943.
Hmm.
The last major German offensive on the Eastern Front is the Kursk Offensive.
Yeah, right.
July 1943. It includes the biggest tank battle in human history, by the way.
Yeah.
Hitler has to call off that offensive. Why? Partly because the Allies have landed in Sicily.
Yeah.
And he siphons these units out of the Eastern Front and sends them down to Italy and Sicily.
Again, the interconnectedness is there.
That's the classic case of interconnectedness and imperial overstretch. In other words, you can't put out all your fires.
Right.
Or look at 1944 with the fact that the Luftwaffe has retracted. The Luftwaffe has pulled back to Germany, as I said a minute ago.
No bombing of Britain, right?
To protect against the Anglo-American strategic bomber offensive. Most of the Luftwaffe assets are back in Germany.
Yeah.
What that means is on the Western Front and the Eastern Front, the Germans really don't have an air reconnaissance capability.
That's astounding.
They can't overfly Russian lines either. And that's one of the reasons why this Soviet Maskarovka works in the same way that Fortitude works. In other words, because the Germans are basically blinded by their lack of reconnaissance, they don't know that the offensive is coming. And they don't know where the offensive is coming, where it's coming. So, and that's all interconnectedness. That's, by the way, that's not the purpose of the strategic bombing campaign, but it has the effect of robbing the Germans of their air assets on the front where they really, really need them. And that helps Allied both Soviet and American and British ground offensives work.
I think this interconnectedness is such an important concept for the Buzzkillers, because we think of these as two sides of a vice coming together.
Right.
And when we not only in terms of the Kursk and Sicily being connected, but mm-hmm. there's materiel and money, if you will, going both
right.
ways. So it really is. It's a two front war, but it's a multi front war.
Multi front geographically, but multi front thematically. In other words, air, sea, and land also affect each other in ways that help the Allies. And by the way, it's going to happen later on too. In December 1944 and January 1945, one of the reasons why Battle of the Bulge goes so poorly for the Germans is that the Soviets launch a winter offensive in January 1945. Which forces them to pull units out of Belgium and send them back to the Eastern Front. Yeah, this happens later on in late 44, early 45, when the Battle of the Bulge takes place. In other words, the last German offensive on the Western Front. They are forced to call that off, and that collapses in part because the Soviets launch a winter offensive in January 1945, forcing the Germans to pull units to the east. So in other words, I'd say think of it this way. The Germans are losing because they have so many fires to put out.
Mm-hmm.
And the fires are being started by the Allies.
The Allies are constantly pressuring
them. And it's not always perfectly coordinated. Sometimes it's luck. Sometimes you could have had better joint planning. You know, the alliance between the Soviets on the one hand and the Anglo-Americans on the other is not a smooth one at all.
No.
But it's not just numbers. It's the fact that they are all pressuring the Germans at the same time, and it's the interconnectedness of fronts once again, which is decisive, not just one front in isolation.
Okay, so we said a while ago that there was the one big gap in the increasing encircling of Germany, if you will, was the northwestern European
That's right.
front. But now that D-Day closes that gap and things
That's
start
right.
to crush in.
Right.
But what D-Day really is doing is more or less adding to this interconnectedness, not creating a whole new side of a war that we didn't think of before.
Right. They're sort of intensifying the interconnectedness. But I mean, it does make a difference, because if you look at how many Germans are engaged, it's a lot higher. Because remember, before D-Day, you've got these German units in the west, which are just sitting there.
Right.
After D-Day, they're in combat, and they're being worn down, and they can't be replaced sufficiently. And at the end of sort of September, October 1944, the Germans do an amazing job of not only defeating the Operation Market Garden, the Bridge Too Far campaign.
Right.
But they do a great job of, with very little resources, stabilizing the Western Front and stopping the Americans and the British sort of at the Dutch-Belgian and the French-German borders. And string out the war into 1945, which is amazing. Because if you look at after the collapse of Normandy, the Germans they're not retreating, they're running.
Yeah.
It's just complete collapse, and the Americans and British are advancing unopposed to the German border.
And also, if the Americans and British are advancing unopposed, and the Soviets are sort of advancing unopposed, does this also mean that the home war industries can just keep cranking up? They're not the resources aren't being put into stopping losses. They're being put into piling on the wins.
Right.
If you saw what I mean.
Yes. And at no point on either side, on either front, do supplies become an issue. Well, I take that back. Gasoline becomes a problem for the Americans and the British.
Right. On
the Western Front, the sort of Patton versus Montgomery thing.
And
here's where the Americans, once they liberate France, their supply lines have become too long. They have this famous Red Ball Express where they're transporting stuff by truck, and you're spending a lot of gasoline running these trucks to deliver gasoline.
And that
becomes a problem. But when things like ammunition and food, Soviets and Americans and British never ever have to worry about those things. They have command of the air. And, you know, once again, if you go to the bookstore, you can be forgiven for thinking that, wow, World War II was really won at D-Day.
Yeah.
Because it's about us. It's about the West. It's a great story. It's an amazing achievement, right? There's lots of good reasons for that. But
the technological achievements and inventions and all kinds of things that happened.
And just the bravery and the resourcefulness of the individual combatants. It's a great story. But from a historical standpoint, you've got to put it in this broader context.
And one of the things about that we find when we put into context is complications. And the picture just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's what I think is so important for the Buzzkillers. this thing about interconnectedness.
Right. Like Theodore Morell would say, injection as always.
That's right. Connectedness, connectedness, connectedness. Well, yes. There you have it, Buzzkillers. Not just another series of myths exploded, but the sort of complications and the context expanded. We'll talk to you next week.